I once heard a pastor say that his dream was to be able to preach his last sermon, pray at the end, say amen, and then the Lord would sweep him away and take him home. The story you're about to hear is from Dr. Pastor Tony Parks, who says, "I am not dying in the pulpit." He said he doesn't know anybody in the African American church, any of his friends, any other pastors who've actually retired from their position. They either died too soon or some life situation actually pulled them out. He walks us through his life journey from the streets of Birmingham, Alabama, under the shadow of Martin Luther King Jr.'s legacy, and takes us all the way up until his retirement. In fact, when you hear this conversation, it's actually 1 week into his retirement, and he is going to talk about what God is calling him to in this season. No matter where you're at, no matter where you're going, we want you to know that there's always life after ministry, and we hope that you're encouraged by this message that's coming from Dr. Tony Parks. Listen in. Hey, well, welcome to the Life After Ministry podcast. I'm here with Pastor Tony Parks. Good to have you here.
Okay, thank you. It's good to be here.
Right now, we are at a conference. It's called Classic City Conference. And we have a bunch of pastors from the Black church, Black community, and really coming here for the purpose of what?
Coming here for the purpose of education.
Yeah.
Studying this week on the book of Colossians.
Yeah.
And pastors coming and learning, getting some expository studies on the text, on and letting it speak to them from different educators with experience from around the country. And I'm here representing an academic institution for those that are looking to further their education.
That's good. Now, what's unique about you is you are freshly out of vocational ministry. Just 3 weeks ago, you preached your last message in your church.
That's correct.
And I want to get to that. But before we get to that, I want to go back to the beginning.
Yeah.
You would say that you were probably not the most likely candidate to ever become a pastor. How did that happen? Tell us a little bit about your upbringing and call to ministry.
Yeah. I'm a native of Birmingham, Alabama, which I'm excited about because of its rich history, both in the civil rights movement, African-American, and somewhat of the church movement, if I must say. As a result of growing up and being there, I kind of got catapulted into the church as a result of needing a home, if I must say.
Yeah.
The church somewhat became my home because at the age somewhere around eight or so, I found myself going to church one Sunday with my next door neighbors, never having had the opportunity to go to church with my own parents. But because of the way the community functioned and operated, a lot of times families would carry children in the community with them different places. And this family was a very loving family and church-going family. And it's almost like wherever they went, I went.
Tell me about growing up in Birmingham and how Jesus met you in this place and then called you.
Great. Yeah, that definitely was a meeting place. I went to church, as I stated, and what's so exciting about my church going and meeting Jesus at that particular time and going to church for the first time, I had a cowboy suit on. Apparently, I had just gotten it for Christmas. It had the streamers and all and two guns on it. And of course, young male, not necessarily knowing any better, that you probably shouldn't wear a cowboy suit to church, but it was what I had.
Sorry.
We were poor, and it probably was close to Christmas, and it was hard to get me to take it off. And so I went to church. Shooters on both sides and caps in the gun and everything. And the doors of the church was opened by my pastor there in Birmingham. And I just saw this man, and he was talking about this man named Jesus, and not necessarily having a father in my life, a man in my life, watching this man talk about another man that seemed to be infatuated with, I deep down inside kind of wanted to know that man. Uh-huh. And when the terminology of opening the doors of the church is an invitation after the sermon to come and let me introduce you to this man. I didn't know any better, I don't suppose. I just got up and did what he said. I went down front. And after going down front, I have somewhat been a cowboy ever since for the Lord. And I got baptized in that church in Birmingham and became part of the community, which was one of the most exciting parts of my, the beginning of my life, because the church is where in the 60s, in the 70s, where was used as the proving ground for young African American men because it was one of the places, it was a haven. And you almost, if you were part of a family and in a community, you went to church and you became involved in the church, you became involved in the ministry. And I remember such things as the choir. I remember such things as the Sunday school. I remember on Sunday evening at 5 o'clock, Crusaders for Christ, which was a training entity. So not having a family, my mom worked all the time as a single parent, I was always looking for a family. And these individuals, without mentioning names, were very active in doing these events, either at church or at home. And one of the probably the most exciting ones were Crusaders for Christ, where we met, and we would always get cookies and Kool-Aid. And that was one of the events for learning the books of the Bible and the disciples. And I can remember now having to know Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua. I had to learn all of that stuff at a very early age. So the Bible was being somewhat poured into me. And the church was also, you went to church every Sunday. And we were still going at 5 o'clock in the evening back then, or meeting at someone's house. So from that point on, the church became not only my family, but it was an extension of my life. And I think it became that extension because the Lord had providentially fixed it, because that was what I was going to need throughout the remainder of my life.
Yeah. What impact did Martin Luther King Jr. have on you as you were growing up?
Well, watching this man eloquently talk about this man that I had learned from in church, and the dignity in which he demonstrated himself, and the just the power that came with who he was, what he talked about, and then living in Birmingham, understanding that some of the things that he was talking about was to help me get beyond what the culture was trying its best to keep me from experiencing. Yeah. And being in the public schools at that particular time, elementary, which was also a very important piece of my growing up, because the teachers were your parents away from home. I remember both men and women. I can remember how they spoke into my life. I can remember not being allowed to come to school without looking kept. Your pants had to be creased. Mm. Your skin had to be oiled. Your hair had to be cut. There are names that I could call out today that would stop you and say, boy, don't come back here looking like that tomorrow. Or she would take you in the closet and she would fix you today the way that she wanted you. I could remember individuals, PE teacher and the principal who we had names for, but we wouldn't let them hear us call them. Yeah. And when we saw them, we went the other way because we knew that they were going to be telling us right.
That's right.
And those parts of the community and that part of life, those were my dads. Those were my moms in the Birmingham community. And for those of us that may be listening or whatever, Birmingham was, and I would be inclined to say still today, because of some of the knowledge I have, is a very influential community, both historically as well as academically. Some of the best HBCU schools, Miles College, which is one that I grew very fond of, yeah. Alabama State University, which I did 1 year, because you always wanted to go somewhere and somewhere you knew that you were going to be familied, if I must say, while you were there. There was no such thing as being alone when you were in those institutions, because everyone in the hierarchy took care of you and made sure you had things. Even if you didn't want it, there were people that watched out for you and cared for you. And that's what I remember to then. And I think in some cases, not only do I remember it now, but I think we have lost a lot of it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of directions we could go, but it does speak to, and some of the conversations that I've had here with some of the folks who've been attending is that there is a brokenness in the family unit within the Black community. But what I've also seen is that there's a community that comes around the next generation to be able to raise them up. And right. I love that term, fam-lead, that we're bringing them in and we're caring for them, because it's a community responsibility.
No question.
Now, you go on to be a pastor, and one day you're going to have a podcast and we're going to get to hear the whole story for the purposes and to stay focused here on life after ministry. You pastored a church for 32 years.
Yeah.
And you led that community. What was that like overall, before we get into the life after ministry? But tell me just about your time as a pastor.
Well, after pastoring that church for 32 years, which was my second church. My first church was about 5 years, 4 or 5 years. And I kind of walked away from that church because I didn't know exactly what I was doing in that first pastorate. And I saw that in that first pastorate, so much that was needed in the lives of those, that community. And I knew that the church was important in the life of a community. And I was missing some of the components of it as a pastor of that first church. Mm-hmm. So I left that church, resigned, and went to seminary and got my master's degree. While I was employed, I was bivocational, and got my master's degree. And while studying my master's, I was called to the church that I just retired from. So I was still bivocational and at this church, and was practicing what I was learning pretty much in seminary. So it kind of began to make sense. It kind of began to make sense. I had been at several churches in Atlanta. It's one of the proving grounds that I was on, watching one of the greatest pastors of the African-American community. And he kind of poured into me also. Man, this guy was just a maverick at pastoring and taking the African-American community in the heart of the African-American community in Atlanta, Georgia, was really important to me because I was not only involved in it, but I lived in it. And I saw how the church and what the church's role was in lifting people up in this church in the city of Atlanta.
And that's what happens when you have a maverick that meets a cowboy. You put those two together.
That sounds
good.
You're
going to flip the town upside down, right?
Well, this pastor was definitely a maverick. Yeah. I mean, let me tell you something. And I desired even more so to work in the church and became involved in the church. The job that I was on after I graduated from college and went to Atlanta, that I received another job for the government that sent me to San Francisco, California. And I went out there, and immediately after going out there, because of my passion for the church, I began to attend another great church under one of the renowned African-American pastors in the San Francisco community. That was very similar to the one in Atlanta. And there I was again in the heart of the Bible belt, if I must say, even in San Francisco, even though the church was in Oakland. This pastor was just everything that I wanted. Matter of fact, my pastor in Atlanta told me, look this church up, because they were good pastor friends. And
Lord provided you mentors.
He did, most definitely. And I stayed there and assigned in San Francisco and got sent to Munich. Now, all the time, I was not pastoring at these two locations. I was very actively involved. I was a what we called a junior deacon in Atlanta, and with a desire to start kind of at the bottom and work, not knowing that I was going to work my way up. But, you know, I don't know if I've been called to be a pastor or not, but let me just work with these deacons. They were hard workers around the church, and everybody looked up to them. They were somebody, man. To be a deacon in the church. So I went out to Munich, Germany after I left
San Francisco.
After I got out there, the Lord moved upon my heart. There was a community called the in the military community. I worked for the government in a military entity, and they called it the Gospel Congregation. And it was so interesting where this was like in the 80s, and even in the military still, there was somewhat of a separation of worship. And the African-American community became part of the military gospel community after the Protestants met.
There you go.
And the Protestants would meet at 11 until, and the gospel congregation would come in after the Protestants, and we would do our thing. And we had a lay minister, and that gentleman became an icon in my life because I got a chance to be a young preacher working under a lay minister where I didn't have all this training. And I say, this is kind of what the Lord want me to do, is to work in the church. So I became licensed to minister, to preach. Yeah. And that's the first step as a pastor in the Black community, a licensee. You have to become licensed, and the church will say at that particular time, we think that you have a word from the Lord to say to his people. And then they give you permission through a set of license to now speak the gospel.
Yeah.
And so after leaving Munich, I came back to Greenville. And Greenville is where I had the first church and then became pastor at the church that I retired from. And what was so interesting about the church I retired from, it was a church that was in a suburban community, kind of. It was totally opposite of what I had asked God for in the event that I ever got a chance to pastor, because I wanted to pastor in the hood. I wanted to pastor black people that were at their toughest point, because not only did I come out of it, but in a lot of cases, especially in Atlanta, I was trained in it, and I saw the need for it, and I felt like I had it in me. And I got stuck in this community. I don't mean to be, for that to sound rude, but I got put in this church in Greenville. It was in a somewhat of the suburban community, because the community was all Anglo. It was houses probably started at $300,000-$400,000. The church was it is 150 something years old now, had been placed in that community as a slave one-room schoolhouse for individuals that had come out of slavery. And I had to go in there and do the best with what we had. And the Lord just provided. The church began to grow, and it grew. And we had a school, a college across the street, university. We pulled some students out of that, and the Lord just sustained us. Built a church while I was there, a brand new church, about 10 years ago, and it's doing well, almost paid for. And I had to identify how to survive in that community. And because how was I going to get African Americans to drive to the car? How was I going to get Anglo people to come, which was the biggest part of it? I had no problem with it. But over the years, and even after 32 years, we built a new church. They became familiar, and I was part of the community with 2 degrees, and all of my degrees were from Anglo schools. I was just as educated and knowledgeable as any of their pastors were, but they never came. And so I began to realize that in some cases they had a problem. Not some cases, they were the ones that had the problem. I didn't. We had fixed the church and organized and structured and did everything we needed so that if you walked in the door and you looked around and you could tell no difference that it was a black church and a white church, other than the pigment of the skin color of the people in the church. It was the epitome of God's house, if I must say, because I worked hard to make it that way. And during that time, I got my doctorate degree from at Westminster. And I want to mention the school because I think it's important to realize and recognize coming from where I came from to where I am, and having gone to Erskine, I feel like that I was just as equipped as anyone else, or better. So that I would be, and that was the other thing that I wanted to do. I wanted to represent not only God, but also I wanted to represent my people.
That's right.
I wanted my people to be proud of me. Mm. When somebody walked into church, I wanted them to be proud of me. When I carried myself, I wanted them to be proud of me. That's my pastor. We have this saying amongst us to the people that the cream always rise to the top, we say, is that make sure you represent well. Yeah. So as an African-American male, and when you step out into the public arena, especially among the Anglos, the goal is to represent. and on how you carry yourself, represent where you have matriculated, and in so many ways, it's real, because the view is and has been, and we feel that we don't get respect unless we are better than the rest. And that comes and came out of the civil rights movement, and it still exists amongst us today.
Yeah. It feels like you're starting from behind, and you gotta
always, you're always catching up. Even when you've caught up and passed, you're still catching up in the eyes of those that have set the standard.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I understand. You've done something that no black pastor has done, you said.
Well, I think very few.
Well, and the interesting thing is you've said this is that you retired from your position as a pastor. You retired 3 weeks ago, so it's fresh.
Yeah. But
you said that most pastors don't actually, in the black community, don't actually retire. They die in the pulpit.
Yeah, they either, retire. There may be people that are listening and see, and to the contrary, split congregations because they couldn't get it the way that they want it, and the congregation wouldn't move for them, or felt that they weren't cut out for it, and primarily because of the history of the African American church and how we came out of, most people, depending on whether it's north or south and in both directions, we came out of the Anglo church. And because we were not allowed to, in most cases, worship on our own, because if we must say the white slave owner or whatever felt that the best place to keep a handle on us was in the church. And so we decided we wanted to pray, we wanted to worship. And it's very important right here, the itinerant pastor is how we became allowed, if I must use the word, to preach amongst ourselves and to our people at the different plantations. We went around and they picked the best African American. And if I use the term, some people would be offended about it, but it's nothing. But they found the most knowledgeable and the one that could read the best Negro in the plantation and made him the preacher. Or he became the preacher because of his relationship with God. So he became itinerant.
Yeah.
And he would move around from plantation to plantation carrying the word. But the word that he was carrying, the master would somewhat listen and make sure that it was not misrepresented to the extent. And that's how revolts were carried on and out, because the message would get out through, in some cases, to carry this gospel we are preaching and teaching is not the same as the one that you're telling us to follow. And that message would get out through that itinerant pastor. And I would mention some names of some historical events right here where I'm from, South Carolina, and being a state that it is, one of the largest drop-off of slavery, slaves in America, in South Carolina. And so as a result of it, they just became itinerant preachers. So as the congregations began to grow and as slavery began to free up, the communities began to grow and the churches began to grow. We began to move into our own churches. And as a result, they needed pastors, but they still didn't have enough. So I remember my first church was the church where we started having five Sundays, where we only used to have four Sundays. Some churches only had two Sundays. Some churches only had one because they didn't have enough preachers.
Yeah.
So as preachers began to hear the gospel, feel the need to be called, they began to fill in those locations. And as they began to fill in those locations, ultimately, churches began to have two Sunday pastors, three Sunday, four Sunday, and what I just got through dealing with. But they were not educated. So the most important thing that occurred in the African-American community after slavery was education. That's why education is so important today. And that's why education should always be important in the African-American community, because we were denied. And it was what was necessary, what the majority culture felt was necessary to keep us ignorant. Mm. Such things as the right to vote, counting jelly beans and not being able to write, and all of that kind of stuff were the things that were used against us. Because so the pastor became the mechanism in which was used in the community to help people rise above that.
Yeah.
And so the Bible was a place to learn to read. So we learned to read the Bible. We used to sneak to read the Bible, to read the Bible by candlelight, did not want to be seen reading, but they learned, they studied, they taught, and the only education they had was the one-room schoolhouse, which was also the place of worship.
Yeah. Now, you have a lifetime of ministry, a lifetime of stories. We should just start another podcast just with that. But you made the decision to retire. You didn't have an elder board coming to you.
Right.
You didn't have a revolt amongst your own people saying it's time. You decided, and you even said that you had a conversation with your son.
Yes.
Don't let me stay in too long. How did you decide that right now is the time? And what was that process like for you?
I watched the pastors, and having been brought up under some of the best pastors in the country, I saw and watched them in the church, and I saw them age out. Mm.
And what does that mean?
I saw them stay in the pulpit until they were not able to do it any longer.
Got it.
And it became very popular. It still is. And as I watched, I began to ask myself, kind of why. And being educated, I used to kind of study, realizing that in most cases, some of those people were bivocational, if I must say. And one of the reasons, and when I got involved into the leadership of the church, found out that they weren't necessarily being paid well.
Right.
So I realized that when I got into it, and I realized that I became bivocational, and the kind of salaries that I was getting, I kind of realized that, though, this is why those guys are dying in the pulpit. First of all, in some cases, they didn't have education. Then they had to work two jobs to pay for their families. And the church was barely making it themselves. So when I became a pastor, my goal was to not to be like what I had seen, and not knowing that I was going to be in for 32 years at one place, it just kind of sneaked up on me.
Yeah.
But in the process of it, I started saying to myself, there's some things that I want to do in the church. I want to, first of all, educate the people. I want to give the people something to be proud of. I wanted to be a light on a hill where this church would be viewed as a beaconing light for the community. And so I had all of those things. So I kept staying in, and became a lot of things in the community, in the state, and around the country. And eventually it came up, and up comes the pandemic. And because the church did not have adequate administration in the church, I felt like I was becoming overwhelmed. with trying to do it all. And that's one of the problems in most of the African-American church. It's the pastor, and the pastor is everything. That's why we call each other doctor, this doctor, because he's a jack of all trades. There's hardly anything that he does not know.
Not a specialist. And, right?
But he knows who to go to find it out. Very remarkable men and women. And so while doing all of that and realizing that I don't think that I'm going to be able to get this church to move to this, to the next level of having an assistant pastor or a Christian education worker or whatever, I was doing mostly all of that. I come to the reality that I was going to wear myself out trying to do it. And as a result of it, I gave the church everything that I had until I came to the point to say that I enjoy pastoring, but I don't think I have the energy to do what I did when I came in. So I realized that it's getting time for me to go. And I asked my son, because I loved the church so much, don't let me kill the church. And also, don't let the church kill me. Me kill the church, and don't let the church kill me. And that became somewhat of a fright of mine, because I was going at such a pace. And then the third piece of that is don't let me kill my family. My wife, God bless her soul, 42 years, stayed with me, and she suffered as a result of my church ministry. My boys, both of them got college educations. They've done well. They're doing well. But they suffered during my pastorate, because it was always the church. And I'm not going to say never, but seldom was it them. And when I began to look back at it, and there's a book that I use. It's called Seeing with the New Eyes. I began to see my family different. I began to see the community different. And I began to see the church. There's some things that we say to pastors a lot is if you died tomorrow, Tony, it said they'll replace you the next day. And I kept seeing that. And I kept seeing churches looking for pastors after they die. I kept seeing churches looking for pastors after they got ill. I kept seeing churches split because the pastor was no longer able to hold the church together. And I started asking myself, is that going to happen to me? How do I keep that from happening? So what I did was is I began to ask God those questions. One of the most important questions I think I asked God was, is Lord, so that I can determine where I am in this ministry, who am I in this ministry? Am I a Moses or am I a Joshua? And Joshua replaced Moses. Moses died. And in the immediate first chapter of Joshua, it says, Moses, my servant, is dead. So I asked myself, will I get a chance to experience the promised land, or will I die before Joshua gets across the Red Sea or Jordan? And that became very important to me, because I wanted to be successful for God as a Moses, but I also would love to take the people to the promised land.
Yeah.
And I knew that Moses didn't do that.
Yeah.
And I said to myself, Tony, how do you fulfill one, if not both, of those responsibilities? So it came to me, make preparations for the exit.
Yeah.
Take the people to the Red Sea and leave them. And that was the decision that I made. So I had to start getting the church ready. And one of the reasons that I wanted to get the things I wanted to do was to make sure that the church did not suffer some of the things that churches that had gone through a dying pastor, a pastor that stayed too long, or a church that split. So what I needed to do was clean up my own house. And the way to do that was from the inside. And I began to look at the structure of the church, because the church was responsible in a lot of cases of killing itself. From within.
Yeah.
And the members needed to be educated. The leadership of the church needed to be pruned, if I must say. And the pastor needed confidence that God had already given him or her what was necessary to carry this out through the Word of God. So I began to follow the Word of God to the extent that I trust God to do what I asked him to do, and that is give me a successor, and ask the church to receive it upon my exit.
So you basically, it's like you moved out of a house, and instead of just leaving all the holes in the walls and say, the next guy's going to have to fix this, you cleaned up the house, you patched the holes, you make sure the foundation is solid, all the pipes are working, you refit the whole house with copper piping, right? And then you're able to pass on this church.
Perfect example of what was necessary. And some of it was difficult dealing with personalities, people, and positions. A lot of people are in the church and they are there because of the position and not necessarily the spirituality.
Yeah.
And fighting positions can be like, fighting the Amalekites, man, you know.
we hold on tight.
Yeah, we hold on tight. And I took a beating doing that, but it was worth it because I knew who I was doing it for.
And in the end, the church unanimously accepted, received the new pastor that came in.
Right. I followed the procedure that goes with the tradition of the church. And a lot of times it may seem by listening to this, and I've had guys tell me I come across as a tyrant sometime. No, but I do come across as a believer in the Word of God, and I believe in following it. And I took the tradition of the church, and the tradition is they have an annual business meeting, and I worked on things year after year after year, and I realized that what I needed to do. Now, mind you, I prepared my home, I prepared my wife, I prepared myself for the retirement, because most preachers can't retire if they're not financially ready.
That's right.
And emotionally,
the biggest obstacle is not even just that they can't transition out, but they don't know what they're transitioning to.
Right. Yeah. And pastors get so tied up in the glory of the position and the title sometimes that they can't and won't let go. And when they do let go, they come to find out, I'm not ready to let go.
Yeah.
And there's fear.
Absolutely.
So the fear of not being ready to get let go caused them to stay too long.
Yep. So this is life after ministry. You are 3 weeks into your new life after ministry. As we wrap this up, what does that life look like? Are you just golfing all the time?
No, believe it or not, I don't play golf. I think I'd be very honest. I'd be very honest with you from the standpoint of I had a fear of retiring.
Yeah.
Of what was I going to do? I've worked 3 jobs my entire life. And that fear is rather than waking up in the morning and not knowing what to do, how long would I last doing that? So I began to ask the Lord to give me volunteer things, give me things to do. And because Over the years, I've prepared myself being a pastor slash teacher. And if you look at Ephesians 4, that's the one position where it comes together with a conjunction. I stopped pastoring, but I haven't stopped teaching. So the Lord opened the door and allowed me an opportunity to utilize the teaching gift that he's given me to fulfill people when they call me for to help. And I am in a teaching role right now. And that's how you and I are meeting. I'm representing an institution. And I'm sitting here relaxing. I've sat in this facility for the last week and meeting guys like you and other people and waking up in the morning, going downstairs, having an hour and a half for breakfast, talking to people from all over the country. You know, doing things, sitting at the table, writing a lesson. I mean, I think that's life.
It is life. It sounds like life, right? There is life after ministry. And I think that that is something that's needed in the church, is to not cast aside when we have our pastors retire, but to utilize and put to work the wisdom that your life has taught you. That next generation needs it. And it's life-giving, I assume, for you to be able to say, I have learned these lessons. I've been there before. And I can show you what this looks like.
And if I must say this, my wife and my two sons are so excited about the opportunity that I have to have retired. And Daddy, what you doing today? Honey, come on home. I got this plan this evening. Put this on the calendar for March. Yeah. So I got a cruise plan with my grandkids.
There you go.
And I'm trying to get my wife to tell me where in the world we want to go for our vacation this summer.
There you go.
And it's something that I haven't been able to do for the past 40 years of my life.
Tony Parks, you've earned it. And what we continue to find in all of these conversations is not only is there life after ministry, but there's ministry after ministry.
Oh, life is ministry.
Yeah. And you're doing it right now. So thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for your diligence in seeking the Lord, for seeking education, to want to live a life worthy of the calling that you've received and impart that to this next generation.
Well, thank you. I hope and I pray that as a result of what we have said in this podcast, that we multiply the ministry gifts that are out there through the pastorate, and rather than take away from the body of Christ, and it will continue to flourish.
And somewhere listening right now, there is a guy in his early 60s who's been pastoring for a while and wondering what's next, maybe scared of what's next, uncertain if he has the financial capacity to make it in the next 20 years, or what is he going to do every morning when he wakes up? And our hope is that your story brings some direction, some clarity for that.
And I hope and I pray, and you can cut this out if you need to, but one of the pieces I like to say to pastors, and maybe use it for someone else to tell you later on, is be careful in the pastorate with the boundaries that we set and we don't set that will prepare us for the opportunity to retire. We don't have the we don't set boundaries financially. We don't set boundaries as it relates to getting ready to live without an income or lose an income or Social Security. All of those things that pastors don't look at, because everything's been given to them on a platter.
Yeah.
And one day, what God is doing is wanting to know, have you been faithful over the few things so that you can experience what he has for you in the future?
Amen. Amen to that. Thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah, man.
Thank you for joining us here. God bless you.
Okay.
Too.
All right. Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening to the Life After Ministry podcast. This is a ministry of pastoral transitions, and we get to walk with pastors, ministry leaders, nonprofit leaders, anybody who is in Christian ministry and trying to figure out what is their next step. We want to be able to come alongside these leaders and be able to say, we have you. We can help direct. What are those next steps? Whether that is going into a season of retirement, we find that a lot of people who are coming closer to the end of their time behind the pulpit, it's not so much the transition that is the scary part, is they don't know what they are transitioning to. And so we are able to walk with these leaders, help them figure out. We know leaders that said, I stayed in my position 2 years too long, and I wish I had some direction. And there's oftentimes not just career coaching and counseling that needs to take place, but to be able to walk through and process the season that they are coming out of, not just the pastor or the leader, but their spouse as well. So that is the ministry, and we find that many times they are not able to afford these types of services. And so we have started a nonprofit arm of our ministry. And if you go to pastoraltransitions.com, you'll be able to see the donate button there, and you can support a pastor. You can even designate it for a certain pastor, and we will be able to walk with them over a series of months to be able to help that transition go to the glory of God and honor with dignity the ministry that they've come out of. Thank you for listening. And until next time, this is the Life After Ministry podcast.